The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's now my honor to introduce Calvin Bud Trillin, well known for his droll humor and laugh-out-loud storytelling. In 1965, I met Bud in London, where he had traveled with his girlfriend, Alice, to get married over there. My then-girlfriend, now my wife of 58 years, was boarding the same plane in New York on her way to see me in London for our fourth date. She had known Bud before, and before me, of course, because she had dated his Yale roommate. This chance meeting all those years ago has surely been forgotten by him, but not by us. During his 60 years of prolific writing, Bud Trillin has authored 30 nonfiction books. His signature focus has been on his late wife, Alice, his family, food and pleasures of eating, and perhaps most important, he's focused on race. He has written also 3 novels, 5 books of light poetry, which contain his wicked brand of political satire, and hundreds of essays in The New Yorker, where he has been a staff writer since 1963. Bud has also been a columnist for Time magazine and for The Nation. Once called the Buster Keaton of performance humor, he appeared in 2 one-man shows, and his loving memoir about Alice was staged as a play. His collection of comic creations entitled Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin won the James Thurber Prize for American Humor. As a food writer, Bud's prose is delicious, in part because he's always hungry. He is attracted to restaurants, street vendors, and truck stops alike. His love of Southern food was colorfully expressed in his New Yorker coverage of a hot tamale festival in Greenville, Mississippi, which happens to be my hometown. One of my favorite quips about what he ate during his childhood is this one. The most remarkable thing about my mother is that for 30 years, she served my family only leftovers. The original meal has never been found. Bud's penetrating reporting on race in America is filled with insights into our country's long history of racial discrimination. Indeed, his first book, An Education in Georgia, is a landmark story of 2 courageous black students, Charlene Hunter and Hamilton Holmes, who in 1960 desegregated the University of Georgia. His collection of dispatches entitled Jackson, 1964, is drawn from his 50 years on the New Yorker race beat. All of these stories are relevant today. Bud's latest release, The Lead, which you can purchase and have signed following the presentation, is a fascinating portrait of journalism and the illustrious people who have practiced it. Joining Bud in conversation is Philadelphia's own Bill Marimal. As a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Marimal twice won a Pulitzer Prize for public service and for investigative reporting. He was editor-in-chief of the Inquirer from 2006 to 2017. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Calvin, Bud Trillin, and Bill Marimal.
Well, looks like a full house here tonight. Bud, are you ready for action?
I think so. They don't look dangerous.
I wanted to start out and tell you how I first encountered the name Calvin Trillin. And this occurred back in 1971, when he was writing the U.S. Journal. And he wrote about a childhood friend named Fats Goldberg. Was that his last name?
Yes.
And also known as Three Case Goldberg. In the course of that, he mentioned some of his the restaurants in Kansas City that he'd enjoyed both as a child and a young man. And then in August 1972, I went to a wedding in Kansas City of my high school friend Tom Horn and a woman named Kathy Calkins, who'd grown up on Belinder Drive, which Bud knows well. Mm-hmm. And at the rehearsal dinner, we had ribs from Arthur Bryant's Rib House. And then in the next afternoon, we went to Winstead's for hamburgers. And those were two of Bud's favorite places. And you can read all about them in the course of some of his work. There are very few writers who can make me laugh out loud. And there are very few who can make me cry. Bud is someone who's capable of doing both. He can make me laugh out loud, and he can make me cry. And when you read Bud's book, The Lead, I want to read a passage from it, which is one of his favorite leads. And I won't belabor it, but I guarantee you that if you read the book and you read his dissection of this lead, you, like me, will laugh out loud. And here it is. It's from a chapter known as The Lead. And he's talking about the fact that you might say that I'm a collector of leads. I assume that's why my friend, James Edmonds, who lives in New Iberia, Louisiana, sent me an article that appeared in The Advocate of Baton Rouge on September 23rd, 2019. If the function of a lead is to engage the reader, this article's lead seemed to me remarkably effective. Here it is. Quote, a veterinarian prescribed antibiotics Monday for a camel that lives behind an Iberville Parish truck stop after a Florida woman told law officers she bit the 600-pound animal's genitalia after it sat on her when she and her husband entered its enclosure to retrieve their deaf dog. And you're going to have to read Bud's book to appreciate and laugh at his dissection of that lead. So one of the things I loved about the book is that Bud goes into a whole array of remarkable characters, most of them journalists, many of them people you've not heard of or you may be aware of just peripherally. Today I was having lunch with my old friend Michael Bamberger, and I started talking about Edna Buchanan. Edna was a police reporter for the Miami Herald who won a Pulitzer Prize back in 1986. And about a week or two before she won the Pulitzer Prize, a profile appeared in the New Yorker about Edna Buchanan by Bud. And Michael, who hadn't thought of the name in 30 years, was able to quote from that profile. So Bud, would you talk a little bit about Edna Buchanan and how you went about doing those stories, which were just remarkably precise and detailed and colorful?
Well, she was a great character, or is a great character, I should say. She specialized in murder, and she and Miami was a good place to be if you specialize in murder at that point. And somebody asked me the other day, what was her special quality? And I said, I think relentlessness. If you were talking to Edna Buchanan and she was asking you questions, the conversation went on a lot longer than you expected. And if somebody got murdered and Edna found that it was better to get out of the neighborhood and back to the office, because she said we're in the actual place of the crime, there was too much yellow tape put there by the police, and she couldn't get at people. So she went back to the office, and she telephoned the next of kin, whoever it was. And if that person understandably thought this was an insensitive and outrageous thing to do and hung up on her, she counted to 60, and then she called again. And she said, I said, what was that minute? And she said, well, somebody else might answer the phone who's a more talkative person. Somebody might have said, you should have talked to that reporter. It was terrible that so-and-so was murdered. And that very person might have changed his mind about talking to Ed Buchanan. And then I said, was that it? Said, she didn't call a third time. That would be harassment, she said. So she was interested, and I talk a lot about her leads because they were often made up of a paragraph that ended with a short sentence, like a paragraph of, you're going to shoot me, so, and finally said, he did. In the Miami Herald, that was known as a Miller chop. That's because Gene Miller, who was a marvelous reporter, I think he won 2 Pulitzers for getting people out of death row. He liked using a lot of reasonably sized sentence and then ended with a couple of words. Somebody on the Herald said, he writes as if he's paid by the period. So I enjoyed being with Edna. She, oddly enough, was a person who had a lot of cats and talked baby talk to them, and it didn't seem like a crime reporter at all.
Another person whom I enjoyed reading about was the late Johnny Apple of the New York Times. And I commend that profile to you from Bud's book. One of the things that I really liked about that profile was, as I was reading along, I encountered someone who'll be familiar to any Inquirer alum in this audience, and that was Doug Robinson, the former city editor of the Inquirer. And Johnny Apple, as Bud will tell you, was a prodigious talent. He was also an egotist and an unremitting braggart. And as a prodigious talent, his colleagues admired him, but as a fabulist in some ways, they criticized him. So at one point, he was in the Albany Bureau with our city editor, or later city editor, Doug Robinson, and the entire bureau would go to the bar and they'd just dump on Johnny Apple, you know, conceding that he was a talent, but deciding that he was, in effect, an asshole. At one point, Robinson decreed, listen, we've got to stop this. We know he's a great reporter. Anytime someone criticizes Johnny Apple, we're going to throw a quarter into the pot, and that'll be used to buy drinks. And so for several weeks, according to Bud, the colleagues honored the moratorium. And then one day, Doug Robinson, who called the executive editor of the New York Times a psychotic maniac, walked into the bar, threw down $10, and said, Apple's such an asshole. And Bud, I'm wondering, after reading the profile, number one, what did you think of Johnny Apple? What did he think of your story?
Well, I knew Johnny for a long time. We were college editors at the same time and met in college. The opening of that profile is an example. I had an editor at the New Yorker named Bob Bingham who always said, Trillin and McPhee start their stories in the middle. It took me a while to figure that out, but the opening of the Johnny Apple profile is an example of that. It begins, The consensus in the trade, I'm happy to report, is that R.W. Apple Jr., Johnny Apple of the New York Times, is easier to take than he used to be. I think what he meant by starting in the middle is, it's as if you jump onto carousel as it's going around. So with the first sentence, you know that Johnny Apple was found irritating by some people. He actually became less egotistical as he aged, and I had a theory once that he was saved by gluttony. this fantastic energy that he had was channeled finally into just eating as much as he could find. And reporters did admire him because and they admired him not only for his writing, they admired him for his expense account. The Times had an accounting system then. I think they were called cost centers, that each department got its limit of what they could spend, and so there was a cost center for foreign news, and a cost center for sports, a cost center for Johnny Apple. At one point I said, you know, I think, Johnny, even though you've never won a Pulitzer, you might get one if you donated your expense accounts to the Pulitzer. I think they would find those worthy of library treatment. And he said, but I can't do it because the Times has them. I don't have them. And he actually took it seriously. He was that rare reporter who is, when he's described in Apple stories, which were sort of a subgenre of reporter stories, if he entered a restaurant, the verb was he swept in. I found him a wonderful subject for a profile, because not only because he was so colorful himself, but also the people around him, the reporters who had come across him, like Doug Robinson, were good at telling stories. Tom Brokaw used to refer to one of Johnny's dissertations as when he was in the full Apple. I'm not sure if he was the last of the swashbuckling reporters, but he was one. And the other thing I should say about him is that he specialized in, I think reporters are generally generalists, but they get to specialize in one thing or another. He wasn't an investigative reporter. He was very good at what I think Times called the cue heads, the analytical things. And he was very good at what is sometimes called in journalism parachuting in, going to a place where he hasn't been, although there increasingly were few places he hasn't been. He did cover Vietnam. Actually, the first paragraph of the profile relates an old story that Johnny, in those days, rather brash, was boasting about being in Vietnam, and that he actually had killed two or three people. A veteran reporter was standing nearby, and he said, "Women and children, I presume." So So even the remarks you made about him were interesting to me.
What did Johnny Apple think of the story? Did you ever get some feedback?
That's a good question. At that period, the New Yorker promotion department used to have a list of people they delivered the New Yorker to on Sunday, I think, when it came out. And he obviously made sure he knew one of those, if he wasn't one himself. And he called me. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He hadn't seen the story yet. He called me and he said, Dick Holbrook called me. Dick Holbrook definitely was one of those people. And said it was a pretty tough story. And I said, let's wait till Johnny reads it. And I think he was okay with it because he said there was an earlier book called Boys on the Bus, which was by Tim Krause, and he said, on one hand, it made me out to be a great reporter. On the other hand, it made me out to be an asshole. And I think that's what he thought of the profile. But I saw him after that. I mean, I guess we had a kind of a longitudinal relationship because it lasted from 1957 or something like that.
Well, I commend that highly to your attention when you read the book. I asked Bud because I always believe that people of his versatility and excellence have mentors. And I asked him about that when we talked on the phone a week ago. And he said, well, I can't really say that I had mentors, but he mentioned three people whose work he greatly admired. One was Joseph Mitchell, who some of you have probably heard of, a New Yorker writer from the 30s and 40s, who in the 50s his productivity started to decline and suffered from depression. Claude Sitton, who was probably the dean of the civil rights reporters for the New York Times during the epicenter of civil rights movement in the 60s, and Russell Baker. And I'd like you, Bud, to tell us a little bit about Claude Sitton. And the reason I ask that is because many of us worked with Gene Roberts at the Inquirer. And Claude Sitton hired Gene to succeed him on the civil rights beat at the New York Times.
Claude and I were in Atlanta during a year, but I guess the fall of 60 to the fall of 61, which happened to be good fortune for us, not good fortune for people who got hit on the head or anything. A year of great activity in the civil rights struggle. There were years when not much happened because Washington wasn't really pushing the issue at all. And Claude lasted for a long time as a Southern in the Southern Bureau of the Times. And you kind of felt in those days that you were like an American news bureau in a foreign country. There was some tension in how to cover the civil rights struggle. There really wasn't any moral equivalency between people who thought that all Americans should have the right to vote and other people who thought that those sort of people ought to have their houses burned down. I mean, it wasn't like covering the Ohio State-Michigan game. And Claude, though, I think, managed to expose a lot of things without any obvious bias, they would have called it, on one side or another. And he called me once on a Sunday night, and he said, there's a race thing in Monroe, I think it's called Monroe, North Carolina. They're shooting people. And he said, let's go. And I said, okay. So we got on a plane and we got over Charlotte or wherever the nearest airport was. And the pilot came on and said, it's too foggy to land. We're going on to our next destination, Indianapolis, Indiana. It could have been Toledo, but I think it was Indianapolis. And Claude said, it's not even in the South. But he was a fine reporter. And after I was back in New York, he had a story in the Times about a voter education meeting in a black church in Georgia where the sheriff, somebody named with a sheriff's name like Zeke or something like that, came in, and I read the story, and it was the, I thought, I was really scared when I read the story. And then I realized I'd probably been scared the whole time and just too dumb to admit it. So he was a masterful reporter.
Could you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Joseph Mitchell and the kind of decline of his productivity at a certain point in his career? He wrote a story called Up at the Old Hotel and a collection of his work, which for those of us who are too young to know him in his heyday, really is a great collection, which I recommend to you.
I thought he was a great writer. The thing I particularly admired about his writing is he got the marks of writing off of the story, and so it just looked like it came out. He was from North Carolina, and like a lot of out-of-towners, made a particular specialty of New York, and. He also, there's something sort of mystical about him. When he first met my wife, he said to her, "You've got the eyes of a Mecklenburg County Scot." Her father had come from the next county. Sometime later, I said, "How did you know that?" He said, how would you know to talk to about being a Mecklenburg County Scot? And he said, well, there were two or three counties there. One of them was more rural. Mecklenburg County, I said, well, how he chose those two counties in the world, I don't know. But I greatly admired him, and to the point where my wife would occasionally say, because he came to the New Yorker every day when he wasn't turning anything in. She said, why don't you ask him to have lunch? I said, I couldn't do that. Like asking a rock star. So I wasn't up to that. I don't like to call strangers on the telephone, which is really odd for a reporter. It's somewhat of a handicap, I have to tell you.
And tell us a little bit about your relationship with and your admiration for Russell Baker.
Well, Russell Baker was a truly great columnist. And he had such control of the language that when you read because some of his pieces were just funny, and some of them were quite serious, but you were sort of put in the mood in the first few sentences. He used to say how he became a reporter. How he became a columnist. He covered the Congress as a reporter. And he said he spent a lot of time sitting outside of these closed committee hearings, sitting on the marble floor of the congressional building, waiting for somebody to come out and lie to him. he would know that they're lying, and they would know that he knew they were lying. And he said, and he also, he came from Baltimore, where people sat on those marble stoops. And in Baltimore, they said, if you sit on the marble too long, you get piles. So he decided he wasn't going to be a reporter anymore. He was going to be a columnist. But I think, like a lot of things Russell said, it wasn't meant to be taken too seriously. He wrote a column about walking on the east side of New York, the Upper East Side, and a potato fell out of a window high above him in one of those high-rises and nearly hit him. And the column was about how you didn't want your demise to be at all risible. There was a point where I was having trouble starting a column, and I said, I'm thinking of going for a walk, and maybe a potato will fall. My wife said, Russell's already done the potato column.
I mentioned at the outset that Bud can make you laugh. He can also make you wince, and he can make you cry. And I highly recommend About Alice, which is about Bud's late wife, a beautiful woman, a great writer in her own right. And I read a book called Messages from My Father.
Oh, yeah.
And in the book, Bud, you said that your dad told you, quote, you might as well be a mensch.
That was his only advice to me.
And I'm wondering, number one, how would all of us interpret that? And how'd you do over these 88 years at being a mensch?
Well, that would be somebody else's judgment, I think. I always thought my father's aspirations for me were pretty simple, that I become the President of the United States, and his fallback position was that I not become a ward of the county. Mensch, as most of you know, because it's practically in the American English language now, is someone who is upright and does the right thing and not only sacrifices for a friend, but also leaves a borrowed apartment nicer than it was when you got there. I like the way he put it, you might as well be a mensch. It's not as if he hadn't considered the possibilities not to be a mensch. But he was, my father was a sort of a bright line guy. If something was illegal, it was illegal. I was the only boy in the Midwest who never drove a car before it was legally permitted. So it's the law, and probably the only small boy who, after he was 12, paid full fare at the movie theater, because my father thought that's the way it is. It's the law. And he had a kind of a playful side as well. He wrote a couple. He was a grocer for most of his life, and then he, after the war, he sold the grocery stores right away. He hated the grocery business, and at one point he had a restaurant, and he had a couplet on the menu every day, usually about pie. His shortest was "Don't sigh, eat pie," and he had things like "All right, warden, I'm ready to fry. I've had my last piece of Mrs. Trullin's black bottom pie." Actually, my favorite of his poems. He wasn't much on meter. He was good on rhyme, but it was "Eat your supper," Mom said gently to her little son Roddy. If you don't, I'll break every bone in your body.
Um,
But in America, and I think in that book I discussed it, even though my father talked very much like Harry Truman and had a lot of Midwestern qualities, actually was born in Ukraine and came as an infant. And I think wanted me to be an American. I mean, in America, son is supposed to outdo his father. I mean, that's the way it is. So I think I did on short poetry. Don't Saeed Pai is fairly short. But I wrote a poem, I don't know if I remember the title, but the titles don't count. The title was something like The Political and Philosophical and Societal Implications of the O.J. Simpson Trial. And the poem was O.J. Oy vey.
But I have one last question before I turn it over to your fan club out there. Mm-hmm. And that is, many of us are reporters and writers ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, for you, mm-hmm. You, in one of your, I think it may be the prelude to The Lead, you say that other magazine writers would say, Bud, how can you do it? One story every 3 weeks. Yes. When your newspaper friends would say, what are you doing with the rest of your time?
Yeah.
So my question is, how difficult was it for you to do the reporting, do the writing? When you got down to writing, did you spin it out, or did you write and rewrite and agonize over every word?
Well, this was done entirely in the typewriter age, and I actually had a sort of a system. When I got home from reporting the story, the next day, I would write a draft that was maybe two-thirds of the length of the piece, and I didn't even look at my notes, and it also got very sloppy, and the language sort of deteriorated. Around the house, it was called the vomit out, and I did it on yellow paper. And then I wrote half of a rough draft the next day, and the next half the day after that. And I'm not sure I ever stopped in the middle of a sentence, but I was pretty, I didn't go over. I stuck to what I was, my goals. And I typed up, some of you may remember, there were some things called carbon packs that, and I turned it in. I went to the New Yorker to type it up. And sometimes I didn't even look at the vomit out after I think what it was taking an inventory of what I had in my head and what would work and what wouldn't work. So the vomit outs I just threw away. And I was always afraid that the cleaning women at the New Yorker would discover one of my vomit outs. And they would laugh and laugh and smash their brooms against the desk like hockey players. And he calls himself a writer.
Bill said he was going to do this, and I didn't believe it. But anyway, I guess, obviously, in the time that you've been doing this, the media landscape has changed a little bit. And I'm just wondering if somebody trying to do something, having a career similar to yours, doing it with the skills that you have, would you be able to do it now? And if the answer is no, or anything close to no, how do you feel about that?
Well, I do think you could have a career in what, the phrase didn't exist when I was doing those things, but long-form journalism or something like that. but not in sort of a general magazine, which they seem to be fading. So I think they're more niche magazines. And then there's that guy who I can't remember who first brought him up, who is in his shorts in the basement writing a blog or something like that. So I think it just takes different forms. But I do wonder, as you read these constant stories about how many people were laid off and which newspaper is closing, or how the number of reporters that a big city newspaper has at City Hall, or whether there are enough to let one of them loose on a long piece at one time, it is dispiriting. Yes, and I don't know whether I would have gone into reporting. I'm not sure if I knew then. I think I sort of stumbled. I think a lot of people my age sort of wandered into journalism because the novel didn't work out or they got a lot of pressure from, I actually had some pressure from my father, who I thought when he sent my sister and me to Sarashan Huli Secretarial School, because his aspirations for me were that they'd be president or not become the ward of the county. Neither one of those people really need to know typing. You send girls to typing school. I think he panicked at the end and wanted me to go to law school. He even sent my Uncle Jerry, the leading intellectual of Saline County, Kansas, actually the city librarian of Salina, Kansas, who was at a conference in New York, sent him up to New Haven to try to persuade me to go to law school. And I said, I don't think I want to go to law school. I see these pictures. There's a guy usually played by somebody like Clark Gable, who at the end of the meeting snaps his briefcase shut and says, I'll have my lawyers draw up the papers. I don't want to be that schlemiel back there drawing up papers all the time. So I don't want to go to law school. Uncle Jerry said, I don't blame you.
You wrote a wonderful piece about the delicatessen in New York where you and your wife and girls used to go, and the owner said if you ever wrote about it, you would not be allowed back. Do you remember that story?
No, I think that would have been Kenny Shopson, who had not a delicatessen, but what started out as what is usually called in New York a corner store, and gradually turned it into a restaurant.
And it had three or four booths.
Yeah,
It
didn't hold many people, but right. There were 900 items on the menu.
Yes! Which brings me to my question. Do you remember what's in an Egyptian taco?
I think it was an Egyptian burrito. It was neither Egyptian nor a burrito. And Kenny had very strict rules. One of them was no copying. So if you heard someone at the next table say, God, the only thing I have here is an Egyptian burrito, and then the waitress comes and you say, I'd like an Egyptian burrito, no copying. But it was a wonderful place, and he was actually a marvelous cook, self-taught, and in addition to the 900 items, and the fact checker of the New Yorker really did count the 900 items. He would assume that one of my daughters, Sarah, would order something that wasn't on the menu, which was Sarah's lo mein or something like that. I can't remember, but it was specific to a person. And I think that that Kenny Shopson's place and PS3 were sort of imprinted themselves on my daughters, and they, as people who lived in Greenwich Village, so he was important. They thought of it as a sort of an extension of our kitchen.
I'm bi-coastal, and I live in Philadelphia, but I also live in near Astoria, Oregon. And there's a great story that you wrote about Astoria and the Flavelles, and I'm wondering how you found that story, and you recall it, I'm sure.
I do remember the story, but I don't remember how I found it. I was sort of desperate in looking for stories during that week, to the point of going down to the newsstand that was then in Times Square and buying 15 or 20 out-of-town papers and looking through them. Most of what I read, what I saw there was, of course, stories about Washington's argument about the national debt or something. But occasionally I'd find a story. The New Yorker didn't even have a wire service. And once or twice, somebody sent me a clipping, and I saw something that interested me on the back of the clipping in the next page. But the Flavelle story was interesting to me because I think partly it was an opportunity to talk about a place, and that always interested me. I used to call it the old Manishtana question. How is this town different from other towns? And Astoria, I thought, was a particularly interesting place. I mean, the first thing people told me when I got there, I think, was something like, the Finns are not Scandinavians. There are a lot of Finns there. Not many Scandinavians, I think.
When you were covering the Freedom Rides in the early days of the Civil Rights Movement, you wrote that, I think it was you and Claude Sitton, were trying to decide whether you were participants or observers, because you were a journalist, whether you should get on the Freedom Ride bus, and how you made that decision, which was to get on the bus.
Well, my view of it was that it was a public bus, and as I say, I was too dumb to be scared. And I thought also, other reporters are getting on, so we better get on. And Claude felt the same way. And I, at some point, someone asked for a rest stop, and the Mississippi National Guard person who had gotten on with a couple of soldiers at the state line said he was supposed to take the bus straight to Jackson. And one of Martin Luther King's ministers, I just lost the name, but talked to the colonel or whatever he was in a fantastically eloquent way. I said the most eloquent request to leave the room I had ever heard, and this reporter across the ways where we were sitting started yelling at the Mississippi guy, and Claude said, "Shut up, you're a reporter." It seemed to me a reasonable compromise that we would ride the bus, but it was Daddy King, Martin Luther King's father, was very good at passing the hat in these mass meetings, including to reporters. And reporters can't put money in Daddy King's basket. But then there's a piece in the book about going to the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides. And I was always accustomed to just quietly leaving when they started to sing "We Shall Overcome." So I started to leave quietly from whatever meeting this was. And then I felt someone grab my arm. And I looked down, it was an elderly woman. And I thought, am I really going to wrest my arm away from this elderly woman. So I stayed, and it turned out I knew most of the verses. So I think the line between being a reporter and being what the religious people call a witness was fading away.
Bud, tell us a little bit about your book club. What are you reading? Who's participating? And how often do you get together?
Well, supposedly about once a month, and until COVID, we would meet at somebody's house, and for dinner or drinks and dinner, and we only read fiction, or I should only read fiction, and the only other rule was that you have to have takeout. You're not allowed to cook. We started out with five couples, and it was more than 20 years ago. And so we've had some losses in the ranks, and we're now down. We replaced a couple of people, and now down to about eight people. And we supposedly meet about once a month, but various sort of calendars get in the way, so it may be a little longer. And I enjoyed it. I messed up on the timing. I got the wrong night or something. Did something like that at one point, and I said, "I'll take any punishment except reading the Magic Mountain again." So it varies a lot. So,
well, we're going to call time out on the field. Bud, this has been absolutely terrific.
Thank you, Bud.
And having read the lead, I recommend it highly to all of you. Get it. Be there. Be square. And, Bud, you're going to get tired signing a book.
Well, I hope so.
So right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.